So, yes, I've called this talk, well, the day has been called, well, it's about views, isn't it? And I've called this talk From the View to No View. And, I think I just want to, in a way, talk about views generally, and then I'm going to go on to talk more specifically about the Dharma Mudras. But also I'm going to talk about the need for an emotional engagement with views, the need for positive emotion. But I want to start by saying that when I was a teenager, I thought I was a Zen Buddhist. I wasn't, but I thought I was. And I used to talk a lot about Zen. And one of the things I would say is that you can't say anything about it. But I could talk a lot about it. And I can remember sharing a house with some people, and one of my close friends, a student at the time, Tim, was studying physics and philosophy. And I think I was a bit jealous of him. He was brighter than I was. He was studying philosophy. I wanted to study philosophy, but I wasn't bright enough to do that sort of joint degree. And I would argue with him endlessly, saying, well, you don't need to study philosophy. It's all in Buddhism. And you just need to be here now and stop wasting your time, man. And I didn't know what I was talking about, and, but it didn't stop me from holding these very strong views about the need to drop all views. I've since changed my mind on this one a little bit. So I've come to realize, primarily through studying Bhante, about the importance of views and how views shape our approach to our experience. They do that so much that I think that they can even determine the experience we have. So in Buddhism, of course, we're trying to have the same realization that the Buddha had. And the views of the Dharma are in a way, our path, our sort of navigation path to that experience. And as such, they're critically, critically important, particularly, perhaps, because they're quite difficult to grasp, difficult to hold, difficult to understand. In the Survey of Buddhism, Bhante talks, when he wrote the Survey of Buddhism in the 50s, he talks about how a lot of writings on Buddhism and translations of Buddhist texts had been done by people who weren't Buddhists, who didn't hold Buddhist views. And he warns against reading those texts and those writings and those translations because they're not coming from the spirit of the Dharma. They're often antithetical to the Dharma. He's later said that these days Buddhism has more to fear from its friends rather than its enemies. I'm paraphrasing, but there's something about how there's a lot of support for Buddhism now, and a lot of people think that they know about Buddhism, just like I thought I knew about Zen Buddhism. And that can muddy the waters. That can really muddy the waters. So I want to, in a way, talk about the importance of preserving right view. And I'm really, really glad that this day has been about views. I think that it's because Bhante cherishes right view so much. I think it's one of the most significant things that he's given us as a Dharma teacher, is his clarity about what right view is and how it leads to perfect vision. And I think that's why he's been so keen to promote this book by Dzongzha Jamyang Kense on What Makes You Not a Buddhist, because it clarifies what Buddhism is and, more importantly, what it isn't. To cherish right view, we have to think clearly. No right view, no perfect vision. If there is no perfect vision, there is no real spiritual progress. So that's Bhante. And I think that we live in a time which is sort of, there can be a strain in our culture which is sort of anti-intellectual, anti-thinking. And I think it's a strain that's invaded the spiritual life, at least in some quarters, and some Dharmic quarters, where people emphasize the need to, in a way, get out of their heads, quite rightly so, to the extent where all thinking, all reasoning is discouraged. When I teach at the Wednesday class, I often ask people what they hope to get by meditation, by doing the mindfulness of breathing, the metta bhavana. And often people say they want to stop thinking. And I kind of know what they mean. They want to stop the random chatter that happens in one's mind. But stopping thinking isn't the answer. It can't be the answer. Ken Wilber is a thinker, a sort of spiritual teacher, a sort of polymath. He sort of synthesizes different disciplines. And I've been reading him over the last few years. And he talks about something called the pre-trans fallacy, where people mix up pre-thinking, which is not being able to reason, therefore not bothering, with trans thinking, which is transcending just the intellect. And in between, you have to think clearly. So he talks about this mix-up where Buddhism is, for example, saying that we do have to transcend the rational mind. But the way to do that isn't to sink below the rational mind into this pre-thinking kind of stage. Let me read you what he says. Because one of the dangers of this, he says, if you sink below thinking, is that practice, spiritual practice, becomes very narcissistic. It becomes a cult of feeling, and often egotistical feeling, a self-centered kind of dharma. So let me read you what he says. So this pre-trans fallacy is what he's talking about. He says, this also leads, perhaps most sadly, to a rampant anti-intellectualism. Instead of trans-intellectualism, which transcends and includes, this anti-intellectualism and anti-rationalism that quickly slides into pre-rationalism unfortunately fosters and encourages a narcissistic approach to meditation and spiritual studies as it slides from world-centric to ethnocentric to egocentric. So these are sort of ever-decreasing sort of spheres of concern, from world-centric to ethnocentric to egocentric. This anti-intellectual narcissism is extremely common in popular culture and in alternative colleges devoted to spirituality. Egocentric feelings are confused with world-centric feelings just because both are feelings. And under this pre-post confusion, anything is considered spiritual if I just feel it and emote it really hard. If I can just feel my narcissism with great gusto, I am getting closer to God or Goddess or Buddha nature, and thus universal care slides to selfish quicker than you can say the me generation. This fearless and exuberant embrace of shallowness has marked too many of the alternative approaches to spirituality. So I think that puts it really eloquently, really strongly. Fearless and exuberant embrace of shallowness. He's very, very strong. So I was kind of reflecting on how do you explain what Buddhist views are. And, of course, it's very, very difficult. I think in the book, What Makes You Not a Buddhist, there's a lot of popular examples about impermanence and about dukkha and about insubstantiality. At the same time, it's still quite difficult to grasp why the Buddha was pointing to these truths. Why these truths? Buddhism isn't like other religions. Bhante, I think, has said, either Buddhism is not a religion or it's the only religion. To differentiate it from what we normally consider to be religion. I've been recently reading Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion, which I really, really recommend, actually. He's rude and he's crude and he's sarcastic. He's very, very funny, very, very witty, and he's a very, very clear thinker. he demolishes so many popular notions of God and why we should believe in a God. Of course, he's coming at it from a Darwinian point of view. And so what he's attacking is a creator God, a personal creator God, who decided one day to create this cosmos. And Buddhism, of course, isn't one of those theistic religions. In this book, Richard Dawkins specifically excludes Buddhism and, I think, Confucianism. He says he's not going to talk about those two. I can't remember if he calls them religions. I think he says he doesn't consider them to be religions. He's not going to talk about those two disciplines, if you like. And one of the reasons why it was an eye-opener for me, because I hadn't realized how popular the notion of a creator God is in modern-day America. Because I think in England, we live in such a liberal, sort of easy-going society that I don't think we kind of realize the impact of theism, certainly not in England. Perhaps in some Eastern European countries where most of the population are Catholic, maybe it has more of an impact. But in America, apparently 99% of the people say that they believe in God, and they mean some sort of creator God. And Richard Dawkins talks about how difficult it is to be an atheist under those circumstances, how difficult it is to stand up and say you don't believe in God. One of the things he says is that if you said that in America, you could not be elected to the Senate. You could not be elected to the Senate. And I was reading recently in The Guardian that out of, I think, 12 of the Republican presidential candidates, three of them have said that they're creationists, in that they don't believe in Darwin. They believe that God created this world, and it's only about 10,000 years old. And another two of them said that they weren't creationists, but they thought that, intelligent design ought to be taught in schools and colleges. And then Richard Dawkins talks about how there's a school in England that was subsidized by the government, encouraged by Tony Blair, that teaches intelligent design. It's a school somewhere, I think, in the north of England. Maybe it's not in England. Maybe it's in Scotland. I forget where. But they actually teach intelligent design. It seems to me quite shocking that in the 21st century Britain, that sort of influence of theism can go on. I read also, this is in America again, there's a creationist museum recently opened in Kentucky where millions and millions of pounds probably have gone into this. They've got state-of-the-art displays, giant dinosaur displays that's going to attract all the kids, with Adam and Eve playing with Diplodocus and things like that, which is kind of, you know, it's scary stuff, isn't it? If it wasn't laughable, it's kind of scary. Now, of course, perhaps that sort of thing doesn't afflict us that much in England. Maybe we're not so easily swayed. Although, you know, with the recent controversy with Salman Rushdie being given a knighthood and Osama bin Laden's successor threatening Britain with terrorism because the government or the Queen or whatever has honoured Salman Rushdie with a knighthood. I mean, you could argue, what's the point of knighthoods anyway? And, you know, isn't the whole thing a sham? And I'd sort of be inclined to agree. But nevertheless, it does feel sort of outrageous to threaten violence in the name of God, doesn't it? But actually, that sort of narrowness and literalism also infects Buddhism, I think. It can do, at least. I was recently reading a book that Deva Mitra brought over from Sri Lanka. It's by a Western bhikkhu, an Australian man called S.S. Dharmika. And it's called The Broken Buddha. And it's a critique of some practices in the contemporary Theravadan tradition. So he's not criticizing the Theravada in the sense of the Pali Canon's wrong or the ideals are wrong. What he's criticizing is the literalism that has infected so many Theravadan, so-called Theravadan countries, and so many Theravadan places, and it makes really, really unpleasant reading, actually really, really shaming reading, that this is what is called Buddhism. And yet, of course, he's saying things that I think are just as sort of outrageous as Richard Dawkins is saying. He's saying them about Buddhism. He's talking about how very often in the monastic Sangha, there's no real spiritual practice, that it's become a formalism, an ethical formalism, where people are really just concerned about the petty rules of the Vinaya, mainly about when you can eat and what you can't eat after midday, whether you can handle money or whether you have to, whether checks count as money or whether you have to wear gloves or you can drop money into an envelope and therefore you haven't handled it, etc., etc. Such petty formalism that stands for the Dharma. And yet we can so easily think of Buddhism as being somehow something that isn't infected by literalism. It is. And probably we've got literalism in our own hearts. It's the third fetter, isn't it? It's the third fetter of dependence of rites and rituals as an end in themselves. And in our Sangha, as individuals, maybe as a collective, we've probably got things to explore there. Although recently Bhante, when he came to the centre, was asked about this, and he said that for us, maybe it's not so much literalism that's the danger, as individualism that just does its own thing and that will sort of devolve into an amorphous mess of a sangha rather than conform to eating before noon, which he sort of he said that was probably more of a danger for us as a sangha. Interestingly, in this book, I wanted to mention in this book, S.S. Dharmika is particularly praising Bhante. It's a delight to read that. At the end of the book, he says that a new sort of Buddhism is needed. He calls for a new form of Buddhism, and he describes, at least in outline, what sort of Buddhism that might be. And then he says, the FWBO is probably a very good model for this. And he praises Sangharakshita. He says that Sangharakshita's a visionary realist. A visionary realist, which I thought was a really, really good term, combining this broad vision with a real pragmatism. And he says that the Dharma needs more, Buddhism needs more visionary realists. He also says that Sangharakshita, that Bhante, qualifies to be considered the first authentic Western Buddhist in the sense of being authentically Western and authentically Buddhist. And he says that he's one of the few original thinkers, Buddhist thinkers, in the last 300 years. It's lovely to read such a sort of affirmation of Sangharakshita, because often I think, certainly apart from my sort of dalliance into Zen, I haven't tried other forms of Buddhism, and I think I can start to take Bhante's clarity and breadth and depth of his insights and teaching for granted and assume that the rest of the Buddhist world is also as clear. And it's not, unfortunately. So yes, there's literalism in theistic terms. There's literalism even in Buddhism, because it's in our own hearts. I was thinking the other day, when I was at college, going back to my college days, every other week we used to have a college bop, we called them. And people used to come from all over the place. Our college bops were sort of legendary. And it was the days of anti-apartheid, and you know, we were trying to disinvest from Barclays and from all sorts of good things. And every college bop would end with Free Nelson Mandela as the song. Some of you might be too young to remember it. Some of you might be too old to remember it. But anyway, for me, it was you know, of our generation, Free Nelson Mandela, and we'd all bop around, pretending to, you know, be in the thick of this African oppression. And recently, I met met a young man, a 19-year-old, through London Citizens. He's doing a summer placement with Telco. He was coming to interview me as one of the trustees and get to know me. And he, it turns out he's at the same college that I was at. And I asked him about whether those bops carry on, and he said, oh, yes, and we end with Free Nelson Mandela every... So, there's a sort of literalism, isn't there? That... a sort of unthinking literalism. I was delighted to hear it, though. For us, of course, for us, perhaps... As Dharma practitioners, we're less likely to fall foul or fall prey to the views of theism. Perhaps that's less likely to happen, certainly sort of extreme theism. Perhaps for us, the danger is more to do with nihilism. A sort of materialism, a scientific materialism. It'd be lovely to be able to talk with Richard Dawkins about this. I've tempted to write to him, but Sudarshini apparently did write to him, and he didn't respond, so I've been a bit put off. Because I think Richard Dawkins is fantastic in what he says, but he doesn't go far enough for me, at least. Because he stops with scientific materialism and assumes that matter can explain everything, and that the scientific method can explain everything, including mind, including consciousness. And I think that's a belief that he has no right to... it's an assumption, it's a belief. It's a bit like theism. Do you know what I mean? How can he necessarily justify that? And Bhante is very clear about this. In the survey, at one point near the start, Bhante's talking about the importance of right motive and the right approach to studying the Dharma. And he says at one point that it might be better to believe, to be an eternalist, to be a theist, than to be a nihilist. Let me read you what he says. It may even be said that a student, that's a student of Buddhism, belonging to a non-Buddhist tradition which affirms the existence of a spiritual world beyond the physical senses and the mind, in however crude and exclusive a form that affirmation may be made, has sometimes a better chance of understanding the Dharma than a conscientiously impartial person who has no belief in the reality of such a world. So the existence of a spiritual world beyond the physical senses and the rational mind, and the mind, as Bhante puts it, is vital if we're going to... belief in that is vital if we're going to penetrate into the nature of reality, if we're going to gain insight. In a way, it comes to the fourth Dharma mudra, where nirvana is beyond all concepts. I think this is pointing to that. That we have to at least have some sort of inkling of faith in such a world that's beyond the senses and beyond the mind. And it's not so preposterous. If you've meditated at all, then we've all, through meditation, I think, had experiences that aren't dependent on the senses and aren't dependent on the rational mind. We've all had such experiences. Perhaps we haven't thought about it in those terms. There's also another sort of a sort of romantic form of nihilism that certainly I was attracted to as a sort of young man. One of the first poems I can remember learning at school was Matthew Arnold's Dover Beach. I don't know if you know it. I'll read you a little bit in a minute. And Dover Beach was, Matthew Arnold was a Victorian. And so he must have been writing under the impact of Darwin's evolutionary theories on Victorian society, where faith was being completely challenged and overturned. And it's a beautiful, beautiful poem. And what he sort of says is that faith, he calls it the sea of faith, because the whole poem is talking about the sea. It's looking out onto the channel from Dover. And he says the sea of faith was once at its full, and now he can just hear its long, withdrawing, melancholy roar down the vast edges drear and naked shingles of the world. And what he concludes by saying, the last stanza, let me read, this was one of my favourite stanzas. I used to sort of use it as a credo, I think, as a youth. What he says is, I'll just read you it. He says, "Ah, love. Let us speak love in the sense of," he's addressing his lover in the poem. "Ah, love, let us be true to one another. For the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night." And I was attracted to all of that as a young man. I kind of thought, oh yes, there's nothing of real meaning in the world. I don't know how I squared that with Zen Buddhism, but I managed to. And we might as well just all be kind of as true to one another as we can, because the world is just full of pain, and hope and light and love are just sort of fantasies. I think I was probably just suffering from unrequited love, and this was a sort of response. So for me, that's sort of nihilism in a sort of very beautiful way. It's a sort of sublime form of nihilism, isn't it? That says, oh, well, there's nothing, so let's just be true to one another. And I think there's something noble about it, there's something attractive about it, but it's still not true, is it? It's still not true. From the Dharmic point of view, it's just not true. It's bleak. And there's no sense of any transcendence there. So in a way, that's one form of nihilism. At the other end of the scale, when you don't have God, you get consumerism, don't you? You just get shopping. And that's probably the sort of nihilism that I'm more familiar with, and many of us are more familiar with. I was at a friend's house a couple of weeks ago, and he showed me a newly acquired thing. It was called an eye fish. I don't know if you've seen an eye fish. He was convinced that this is what he loved it. He was given it, actually, but he asked for it and then was given it. It's a thing that you can plug your iPod into in the shape of a fish. Actually, there used to be iDogs, somebody thought of a dog fish. And so it's a shape of a fish. You plug your iPod into it, and it plays you music from your iPod, and it moves, and it lights up, and it makes its own noises in time to the music, and the lights blink at you. It's a sort of must-have. And at least that's what I kind of went away thinking. So I looked on Amazon, iFish, and I found a whole array of eye creatures that you can buy. And I've got one here, actually, that I managed to... This is an eye dog with a difference. It's called a spy dog, because it's Spider-Man in dog form. And you can plug your iPod into... I'll turn him on, because he's asleep at the moment. And you just press... And he... You have to be quiet. That's if you waggle his tail. And he doesn't like it. And he... Oh, he won't do it again. If you tap him, he moves, you see? And I'll turn him off. But I kind of like to... not not just as a symbol for consumerism. I took a fancy to it. Anyway, I bought it. I bought it as a present, though, so it's all right. So we've got our own sort of banal form of nihilism, haven't we, that we can be attracted to. I've lost the plot. So we've got literalism in theism, haven't we, and then we've got nihilism, and the importance of right views as transcending in a way, or the middle way between those two, and transcending both of those, transcending them. So we do need to, in a way, go beyond reason, but to do that, we've got to find the limits of reason, and then we step beyond it. Yeah, not by pretending that reason doesn't help. Jnana Ketu is doing these days on clear thinking, and there's an Ordo Mitra day that I've organised for August. Unfortunately, it's only open to men, but if you want to, then we might be able to organise another one, because he's got a whole workshop, and maybe we could have men and women, or Shubha might be interested in doing just one for women, and it's a workshop on clear thinking. Okay, I'm not going to say more about the importance of views and reason and clear thinking, at least not in general terms. The next sort of heading of my talk is the need for positive emotion, because reason doesn't go far enough without positive emotion. Our views remain either superficial, sort of paper thin, or if we do take on reflecting on the Dharma more deeply, then we'll easily end up in despondent or despairing states if we reflect on impermanence, for example, on dukkha, without sufficient positive emotion. And by positive emotion, I particularly mean metta, and I particularly mean shraddha. So the Ratnaguna Samchayagata, this perfection of wisdom text that Bhante does a beautiful commentary on in Wisdom Beyond Words, starts with, call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith. Remove the obstructing defilements and clear away all taints. So call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith before you hear the perfection of wisdom. In order to hear the perfection of wisdom, we'll need to call forth as much as we can of love, of respect, and of faith. One of the Buddha's insights, Bhante says, that one of the Buddha's insights, unique insights, is that our views stem from emotions. The underlying our views are emotions. And we're not going to be able to just change our views without looking, working on changing our emotions. This is Bhante from Wisdom Beyond Words. If we really want to root out micchadittis, that's wrong views, if we really want to root out micchadittis, we have to work with our most deeply rooted conditioning in a way that challenges the most radical of conventional values. So as soon as possible, we want to learn to leave our negativity behind and turn around and start exploring something completely different. We want to start releasing not just the anger and the pain, but the love and the delight and the appreciation that we have also perhaps repressed for too long. So I was thinking that the metta bhavana is a practice that embodies right view. Yeah, it embodies right view. I think it embodies right view more explicitly than the mindfulness of breathing or just sitting or so many other practices from the Buddhist tradition. The metta bhavana embodies right view, and it's working directly on our hearts, on our emotional life. The fifth stage of the practice is if we can really do the fifth stage, that would be breaking through the subject-object dichotomy. That would be insight if we could really do the fifth stage. And of course, to get to the fifth stage, we've got to look at our responses to ourselves and to other people. I was also thinking, in that sense, whether you do the practice formally or not, whether you actually meditate, doing the metta bhavana or not, those five stages are in a way a template for a Buddhist life. They're a template for our responses to ourselves and the world around us, to people around us. Sometimes I try and do this on the tube or in supermarkets or sometimes driving. I try and pretend, as it were, that I'm in the fifth stage of the metta-bhavana or doing the fifth stage of the metta-bhavana. And when it works, it's just brilliant. It's just brilliant. You know, it's sort of in the car, I can just allow people to, stop for them. You know, or if they cut you up, you sort of, you know, you're doing the metta-bhavana. On the tube yesterday, I was going out to, well, to the cinema, and I was doing this, and actually it didn't take very much effort. Suddenly I could see this crowded carriage as human beings just like me, and I felt very, very happy, almost ridiculously happy. People must have thought I was a bit daft because I was grinning on this crowded train. And you can do that. You can do that. And of course, metta isn't just a feeling. Metta it involves reason. It involves views. It involves action. It involves all sorts of things. Again, when we generate metta and compassion, this involves mental, rational activity, not just feeling. Metta is the synthesis of reason and emotion, right view and skillful action, unobstructed spiritual vision, and the bliss of a warm and expansive heart. That's beautifully put, isn't it? That's Bhante again. That's beautifully put. Metta is the synthesis of all of those things. True metta is the synthesis of all of those things. And Maha Maitri is metta elevated to insight. Yeah. So all of that arising from a seeing through the delusion of self. And particularly there, what I was struck by is that metta expresses itself in skillful action. So I think we need to differentiate. Bhante was talking about this recently. Differentiate in a way between kindness and sentimentality. It's another one of those things that I think our popular culture gets mixed up, kindness and sentimentality, and particularly in spiritual circles, such as, you know, our Sangha, it's easy to mix those two things up. And sentimentality isn't kindness. It's normally, in Ken Wilber's words, narcissistic. It's more to do with how we are and how we feel and what we want and how lovely we are to, you know, feel sympathetic than to do with the objective situation. And Bhante says that sometimes if we are prone to that sort of over-subjective feeling, it might be because our thinking capacity isn't integrated enough with our feeling. So we can swing from a cold, overly rational, overly objective way of analysing the world, and then, you know, when the time is right, as it were, we swing to the opposite pole of just getting sentimental and overly subjective. And Bhante he's not sentimental, is he? He's not sentimental in the slightest. At all. It's a shame that only order members were, in a way, allowed to the question and answer session he did a couple of weeks ago, a week and a half ago. Hopefully he'll do something for the wider Sangha when he next comes down. But he came into this room full of order members. It was lovely. It was fantastic. And we'd got some pre-prepared questions that he was going to have read out. And it was, for me... Well, for everybody, I think, probably, for him as well, it was a very special occasion. Just him being here, sitting on, you know, just there on the shrine, a room full of his disciples, ordained Buddhists, our teacher, who hasn't been at the centre very often in the last, 10 years or so. And he's sitting there. He can't see very well. There's a poignancy just to the situation, but he was sort of ruthlessly unsentimental about it. Maitre Bhante was reading the questions, and Bhante just said yes, and the first question. And at one point, Maitre Bhante said to him, and there are quite a number of questions to go, and Bhante said, well, you better get on with it. in a very kindly way, but not sentimental. You know, he could have said how lovely it was to be here and da-da-da. But, you know, he was just interested in communicating the Dharma, using his energy and the time that he's got to communicate the Dharma, clarify wrong views. And that's real kindness. That's real kindness. I know that a lot of people have trouble. Every time metta and the importance of metta is mentioned, people can, particularly if you have difficulty cultivating or generating or developing metta, it can feel like you're just being told off. And I don't mean to do that. I really don't mean to do that. All I want to do is sort of encourage the cultivation of metta and the valuing of metta and the valuing of the metta-bhavana practice. And if you don't get on with the metta-bhavana practice, there are plenty of other ways of developing, cultivating kindness through action, through reflection, through recognizing that we're not perfect and that we don't have to be. Sometimes why people have difficulty, I think, is because they set the bar too high. And then, of course, they fall short. And then it's easy to ditch and the whole thing and get disheartened. So we're not perfect. We don't have to be. So we could be lighter about ourselves. We could be lighter about the spiritual life generally, not try and force the experience. At the same time, be determined and consistent. And I think we do need to look at our views in all sorts of ways. When I was new to the FWBO, psychotherapy and, all forms of psychotherapy tended to be frowned upon as, not needed. I've come round to thinking, for some people, they're genuinely helpful to help us look at our conditioning. It might be genuinely helpful. At the same time, I feel really hesitant about saying that because I think it's genuinely helpful if you've got a therapist and a therapy that has right view somewhere at its, either at its heart or that it's leading to right view. Yeah. So therapy in the context of trying to practice a dharmic life might be really important and useful, I mean. But it's important to look at what the views are. Yeah. What are the views? Okay, I'm not going to say more about that. Shraddha. Shraddha is often, I guess, misunderstood. I guess I'm not going to say very much about it. It's just that the Lakshanas and the Dharma Mudras that we're going to look at they're not just scientific truths, although you could approach some of them. You could approach impermanence just as a rational truth, couldn't you? You could say, okay, let's look at life. Let's look at everything. And yes, it's true. It's not permanent. But that's not what the Lakshanas are kind of about. They're gateways. They're doorways into the transcendental. Yeah? Reflecting on impermanence is meant to be a doorway into insight, into liberation. And it's only going to be that if it's reflected upon in the context of Shraddha. Yeah? Shraddha that has at least an openness to the possibility of a transcendental world that's beyond the realm of the senses and the rational mind. Yeah? So it's no good, in a way, approaching these Dharma mudras without positive emotion, Shraddha. Without metta, we'll just get despondent. Without Shraddha, where's this doorway? It won't open. Okay, so that's in a way my second appeal or a kind of general point, which is about the importance of positive emotion, the importance of views, the importance of positive emotion, and then the synthesis of the two. So actually, in a genuinely healthy individual, Bhante says that the two aren't separate. Feeling is thinking, thinking is feeling. They become the same faculty, they're not intention. Okay, so I want to just come now to look at these four Dharma mudras. I'm not going to be able to say a lot about them, but I'll see. So a general thing to say about the Dharma mudras, because they're the Lakshanas, aren't they? The three Lakshanas and then this fourth Dharma mudra, which is that Nirvana is beyond concepts. A general thing to say is that it's a good idea, if you can, to reflect on these Lakshanas in your everyday experience, provided you've got metta and shraddha. It's a good idea to start seeing the world through these lenses of impermanence, of dukkha, of anatman. It's a good idea because what we're trying to do is soak the mind in these perspectives so that insight can arise, so that when things fall apart for us, well, we don't fall apart, but actually we gain some sort of insight into the nature of reality, or the heart opens into a greater sense of connectedness with other people and the world around us. That's what these views are about, and we need to soak ourselves in them. So I can remember Subhuti saying, you could pick a Lakshana, and you could just see if your experience fits with that Lakshana. Reflect on impermanence in the light of your experience all the time. Yeah? All the time. So yes, I'll just that's the kind of general point. Impermanence, the first of these Dharma mudras, it's a profoundly positive teaching. That's the other thing to say. It's a profoundly positive teaching. Impermanence is pointing to, as I say, the transcendental. So it's pointing to the way things really are, and that's profoundly positive. So positive that it's our lack of imagination that I think prevents us from experiencing it, some of the time, at least it's my lack of imagination. If we could really see the way things are, if we could really appreciate what the truth of impermanence is about, there'd be a liberation, there'd be a freedom, there'd be a clarity, there'd be a joy in our experience that would be unbounded, yeah, more than perhaps anything that we've ever experienced before. And that joy wouldn't be dependent on us getting what we think we want out of life. It wouldn't be dependent on the eye dogs or the spy dogs or things working out. It would be a joy that would be, it would have transcended all of that. It would have transcended everything. It would be a spontaneous arising from seeing reality and realizing that we're part of this web of. Well, it's not even just web of life, is it? It's the web of the universe. It's the web of form. It's the web of existence. And we're part of that. And that's flowing. That's changing. That's changing all the time. If it wasn't, how would life exist? So impermanence means life. It means beauty. It means being part of something, being connected with something. So I think we do have to beware despondency. When we reflect on these lakshanas, we have to beware despondency of despair. If you find yourself getting despondent or depressed or despairing about these lakshanas, think again. Yeah, back off. Develop more metta. Develop more shraddha. Go and see a film. But don't go down this nihilistic route. It's not worth it, and it's not the truth. It's not what it is. Well, yeah, just to come back to Shraddha, we do need a sense of direction in our lives, I think, a sense of higher values. And for me, I feel very, very grateful for having stumbled upon the Dharma, primarily because it's given my life direction. Yeah? Regardless of whether I ever reach some profound realization or not, my life now has a direction, and it never, never did. And that is such a joy it's a joy to me. And in a way, whatever falls apart, and my life will fall apart, as it will do for all of us in the end, that direction is very, very precious. Without that, what have we got? What have we got? At the cinema yesterday, or maybe the day before, because I've been twice, I saw Harry Potter, which I enjoyed, and I didn't think I would, and a French thriller with Brian called Tell No One, which I also enjoyed. So they're my recommendations. I've got another one coming up. Anyway, at the cinema, Judi Dench was in an advert. She wasn't... Actually, just her voice was in an advert, but her voice is so much her, really, isn't it? And she was doing an ad for Vodafone, of all things. I don't know why she has to do that. I really don't know why she has to do that. Anyway, she did an ad for Vodafone saying that the internet is now mobile, whatever that means. So you can make the most, it said, of every minute of your day because the internet is now mobile. And the tagline was, make the most of now. Make the most of now. there's all this sort of Buddhist jargon, isn't there? Selling mobile phones. Make the most of now. And without this direction in life, that's all we've got. We've got making the most of now through and mobile phones. So yes, Shraddha, a direction in the light of that impermanence. And in the light of that, impermanence ceases to be a problem. It starts to become this liberating gateway. So I'm going to move on. All emotions are pain. So in the book, he's just being provocative, isn't he? I like that. He's being really, really provocative. But it is misleading, perhaps, if it's not understood properly. He's talking about the truth of dukkha, isn't he? Of unsatisfactoriness, all emotions being pain. What he means is, I think, is that all self-centered, egocentric emotions will lead to pain in the end. And to the extent that it's self-centered, to the extent that it's self-referential even, it leads to pain. Yeah? It doesn't mean that metta, for example, in its fullness, is painful or leads to pain. That leads to an opening of the heart. But anything that's self-referential will, because it's based on a delusion of self. And that truth of the pain of conditioned existence, is a heart truth. It's not something that we can just grasp with our minds. Or if we do, it's not enough. It's a heart truth. It's a truth that's calling to our hearts to open, to allow a sensitivity to arise, which responds to the world, which responds to life in the world, responds to the pain that there is in the life in the world, and see our connectedness with that. So, in order to do that, you don't have to experience painful states. Yeah? You don't have to be in pain to open your heart to the truth of dukkha. Bhante was saying that you could be in dhyana. Dhyana, remember, is the highest, most pleasurable experience that conditioned existence can offer us. Yeah, at least, you know, fourth dhyana or whatever it is. It's supposed to be the very pinnacle of mundane existence. And Bhante said you could be experiencing dhyana, the bliss of that, and at the same time have an insight into the fact that it's painful. Yeah, and because it's conditioned, it's painful. Yeah, it's because it's limited, it's because it's transient, it's because it can't meet our longing for the unlimited, for the unconditioned, for the unbounded. So you don't have to experience physical pain or emotional pain to have an insight into dukkha. Sometimes it's when you're in a positive state that you can have more of an opening of the heart. So yes, dukkha is a heart truth. I mean, you could reflect on how even when you're happy, even when everything's going well, it's normally at some our happiness, particularly in this country, in the West, in this wealthy West, is probably at some other people's expense, isn't it? If we're honest about it, we've bought our happiness at other people's expense. Well, I won't talk about, you know, all the state of the world, but it's obvious, isn't it? Also, I think when we reflect on dukkha, what's helped me in the past, anyway, is to see it in, try and see it in universal terms. So we experience our own dukkha, and we've all got it, and then we try and imagine. This is what the Bodhisattva ideal is, isn't it? We try and imagine that all beings experience that sort of dukkha, yeah, at some stage or another. So it's not that we try and pretend that we're not in pain, or that or that other beings are in more pain or less pain or whatever. It's just that we recognise that this is our common heritage from conditioned existence. There is unsatisfactoriness. There is some sort of loss. There is some sort of transience. And if you can do that in a positive enough state with enough metta and enough shraddha, it opens the heart and actually it leads to a liberation from self, from sense of self. Well, it will do, won't it? Charlotte Jo Kobeck, I've been reading her book Nothing Special. She's a Zen teacher in the States. And she talks about how life is in a way about sort of riding a hurricane. She has this analogy of a hurricane that sweeps through a city and destroys everything in its path. She says, interestingly, in the eye of the hurricane, everything's completely calm, and there's a real moment of peace. If she talks about how she's experienced a hurricane passing through, and you get one side of it, don't you, passing through, and then everything, she says, becomes deathly quiet, deadly calm. For a while you think it's gone, but you're just in the eye of the storm, and then it passes through the other side. And she says that in a way life is like riding that. You can't make it work out, but you might as well. She says, imagine a glider in that hurricane. That's what we're like. We're like a glider in that hurricane. And it will destroy us in the end. But why not ride that hurricane? And why not open our hearts to the world? And of course, this realization that dukkha is universal, I think, also leads to the capacity to forgive each other, to forgive life for not working out. I was just very moved recently to read about it was a newsletter from Amaravati, the Thai forest tradition, and their newsletter comes to our community. And I was just very moved to read about a nun at Amaravati. Who she seems to be an extraordinary woman. I won't go into her life. I mean, she's had an incredible life. But she's Cambodian, and she lost her husband to the Khmer Rouge. Her husband was a minister of state, and she was high up in government as well. And they got separated. She escaped, and she lost her husband. And she goes back after the atrocities are over, in a sort of reconciliation meeting, and she stands up, and she knows that she's going to have to say something reconciliatory. And she says, she's able to find the words to say, "I forgive you," with these people around the table who had done the most horrendous things. I won't sort of mention some of them. The newsletter sort of mentions some of the atrocities. And she's able to say, "I hated you. I hated you for what you've done. For what you've done to my family, my country. Please forgive me for that hatred." I just want to read you something else. I've recently been reading this book, or was reading it a while back, Vikram Seth, and a book called Two Lives. A very beautiful memoir of his great-uncle and great-aunt, who... Vikram Seth's an Indian writer. His great-uncle, Shanti, was Indian. His great-aunt, Henny, was German. And their lives span the 20th century. So these two continents kind of met in their marriage. And their lives spanned Indian independence, partition, and all the... pain and slaughter that caused. Henny, his great aunt, was a German Jew and lost most of her family to the Holocaust. She managed to escape. Their lives spanned all these major kind of decades of turbulence in the 20th century. And Vikram Seth uses this very, very beautiful, loving, detailed reflection on these two lives to look at the whole of the 20th century. And he finishes, I'm just going to read you this last paragraph. He finishes by reflecting on the past and reflecting on the future as well. And he went back at the end of the book to Hendon, which is where they lived in North London, and he says that he visited a memorial garden in Hendon, and this is what he saw in the memorial garden. He said it was a sign. There was a sign requesting people to respect the peace of this place, and it was printed in English, Urdu, Chinese, Greek, Gujarati, Hindi, and Arabic. As I leave, I glance once more at the gate of the memorial garden. On it, in silver metal on black, is a single word in Hebrew. In a flowerbed to the side, so small as to be almost illegible, is a sign that mentions the Jewish Holocaust in the context of more recent events in Cambodia, in Bosnia, in Rwanda, and goes on to explain the single word above the arch, le zikaron. The meaning refers to the importance of looking forward as well as remembering the past. As I walk back to the tube, I consider the word in the context of an evil century past and a still more dangerous one to come. May we not be as foolish as we are almost bound to be. If we cannot eschew hatred, at least let us eschew group hatred. May we see that we could have been born as each other. May we, in short, believe in humane logic and perhaps, in due course, in love. And I think that that's what Dukkha can do, reflection on Dukkha can do. It opens our hearts to the universality of our condition. Okay, so lastly, in terms of the Lakshanas anyway, insubstantiality, I'm not going to be able to say much more about this, apart from to say that emptiness is a concept that can be bandied around in the Dharma, and it's not a thing, it's not a concept, it's an experience, and it has to be felt in our being. If dukkha is a heart truth, insubstantiality feels to me like a being truth. It involves the whole of our being, our physical experience, our emotional experience, our conceptual experience. It's what makes possible the whole of the phenomenal world arising as the play of emptiness. And the only thing I do want to say is that I think the reason that we don't experience this profound spaciousness, the only reason I don't experience it, is because I'm used to holding on to myself. And I don't mean just intellectually, I mean almost physically. To be embodied is to hold on to self. Then we defend this notion of self, don't we, with our greed and our hatred. And if we're going to experience something like the spaciousness that's being talked about, then we have to be trying to let go of this holding on. And that will involve trying to let go of our greed and hatred. It will mean eroding the greed and hatred through ethics and whatever else we can do. I mean, recently I was at Vajraloka and at Vajratuta, and I had this sense that not only do I hold on, this. In fact, I was reading Vikram Seth at the time, and not only do I hold on, but the greed and hatred that drives that holding on, or that fuels that holding on, is exactly the same greed and hatred that that created the Holocaust and created the genocides all over the world. It's you know, I might be more civilized, or that greed and hatred might be more sublimated, but it's the mechanisms of egotism, and they're exactly the same. It's quite shocking to see, really. Okay, so lastly. It's the fourth Dharma mudra, from the view to no view. Nirvana being beyond concepts. In Wisdom Beyond Words, Bhante tells the story of the Emperor of China meeting Bodhidharma. And the Emperor of China wanting to know what truth was, wanting to gain insight. And he says to Bodhidharma, "What is the highest truth of the holy doctrine?" And Bodhidharma says, "Vast emptiness and nothing holy. Vast emptiness and nothing holy." Yeah? And the emperor's sort of thrown by this, can't understand what Bodhidharma's talking about, and says, "Who is he then who stands before me? Are you not a holy man?" And Bodhidharma is not fazed by this. He's not fazed, or he's not going to come down into a more mundane level. And what he says is, "I don't know. I don't know." Because this experience is beyond concepts. It's not something that one can know. Yeah? The Buddha talks about the experience of enlightenment being like being released from prison after decades in prison, walking out into sunshine, or like putting down a burden that you've been carrying on your back for miles and miles and miles in hot weather, and then you put it down. It's that sort of release, that sort of relief, that sort of liberation that he talks about. And certainly when I felt closest to the Dharma, it's been with that sort of freedom and joy. Bhante's take on this, I think, is that rather than worrying about what nirvana is like, one way that we can approach it more safely is through symbolism. Because symbolism hopefully won't be taken literally, and yet it speaks to the heart as well as to the rational mind, or it can do. It can speak to our whole being. You know, I think that this is a real gift of his to our movement, to emphasize archetypal symbols, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, but also emphasize the power of imagination as a way that will lead to insight. I recently went to see the film Sunshine. I don't know if you've seen Sunshine. Sunshine's such a good film. I'm going to show it here when I can, when it's out on DVD. And one of the simple, I mean, they're moving towards the sun because the sun's dying, and they're going to regenerate it. And Kay Mananda didn't like it, and and he's wrong. In the film you see this vast sun that they're moving towards, this fantastically beautiful orange sphere of light and life. That they're moving towards, that actually encompasses the whole field of their vision. And it's the source of all life, and it's dying. And they're moving towards it to try and regenerate it. And there's this awe and this reverence about that image that the characters in the film see. And at the same time, they know that it'll annihilate them. It'll annihilate them if they get too close. It'll destroy them. And yet there's this fascination about moving towards it, which feels to me like a symbol for the transcendental. We know that it'll annihilate us. We know, in a way, it'll annihilate our egotism. There's a beauty and a fascination and a sort of inexorable draw to it that you can't look away from. So, yes, I kind of want to finish there. So just in summary, I've looked at the importance of right view and the importance of reason. I've looked at the importance of positive emotion and the synthesis that needs to happen with reason. And then the four Dharma mudras in the light of those, and how, in a way, we have to see them as doorways, not as ends in themselves, to something that's far, far more positive than we can possibly imagine. And that far, far positive thing, the transcendental, is often best approached through symbolism. And I just want to finish with the symbolism of the meditation practice, the sadhana practice that I've been doing for the last few years, which is a Manjigosha. And Manjigosha, to me, in a way, is like this orange sun. He's both beautiful and awesome and potentially terrifying. And he holds to his heart the perfection of wisdom. He holds the book of the perfection of wisdom to his heart. And in his other hand, he holds this sword, which is a flaming sword that's going to cut through. It's going to cut through all delusion and all wrong views. It's also going to cut through egotism, isn't it? It's going to cut through everything that I think of as me. He speaks. He speaks. His Manjigosha means gentle voice. And his voice is gentle, yes, and it's kindly. But it's also the lion's roar, and it's also the whispering of the air and of the sea. He speaks, and he's whispering to our hearts. And I like to think that he's whispering all the time. He's whispering all the time. And all that we have to do is, in a sense, all that we have to do is, learn to hear it.